Blog Talk Radio.
This is Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. During the last week or so and each of my shows, I decided to take a moment to look at past presidents, those that were founding fathers all the way up to the present time, and see which of those particular ones during slavery did anything to alleviate slavery. Of course, we know they didn't. But we wanted to find out at least what did they do. During this present election year for the president of our country, I feel it is important to know what previous presidents did to stop slavery. So last session, we looked at George Washington and found out he was all talk and no action. And he's called the father of the country. Can you believe that? And his words and his actions were very, well, let me tell you what he did. Before he became president, he had over 100 slaves. And after he left office, he had 317. He also talked about freedom, and he was against slavery, but increased the number of slaves he had during the time he was in office and even after he left office. And only one of his slaves was given this freedom after his death. Our second president was John Adams from Massachusetts. He owned 7 slaves, but gave them their freedom when he became president, spoke out against slavery, and that may be something that, because at that particular time, you have to understand he was from the North, and there was a demarcation between the North and the South. The South was known because of its cotton. The North had not developed the industrial complex yet. So there was a difference. The North was still doing some mundane things in terms of its growth, and farming was not done all year round, so cotton could not be utilized in the North. And maybe that is the reason why John Adams, because of him speaking out against slavery, only served one term as president. He wasn't reelected after one term. George Washington served 2 terms. The third president, Thomas Jefferson, from all that I can understand from my research, it's very interesting to find out that he was all lip service also, as was George Washington. And you know what's so remarkable about both of these people, and including John Adams, but John Adams is a little different. He did try to fight it. You might find out that Thomas Jefferson had 75 slaves, and after he died, only, I think it was 4 or 5 of them were set free. He wanted to take black children and train them and then send them to other countries to work. I guess this was his way of trying to deal with slavery. Very intelligent man, but in this particular situation, when history looks at him in terms of what he did for people of color, it's null. The fourth president, who was James Madison, another Virginian, and by the way, Thomas Jefferson served 2 terms. And the fourth president, James Madison, also from Virginia, as was George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, served 2 terms. And is considered one of the founding fathers. He had over 100 slaves and never freed any of them after his death. It's very interesting. Not a one. Going one step further, he prepared what we call something that was really nasty when you consider it. He came up with what's called the Three-Fifth Compromise. The Three-Fifth Compromise was a battle between states that indicated that those that were Missouri tried to fill out the application and become a slave state. One good thing that James Madison did, which is probably a saving grace in terms of slaves and in terms of people of color, he went one step further with the compromise, and that compromise actually was one of the things that made black people less than human, 3/5 of a human. But the but that was a sort of a negative situation in terms of the compromise. Today, we will look at the sixth president of the United States, and that's James Monroe, who was known for the Missouri Compromise, and another Virginia slavery from Missouri. But he helped to ban slavery from different territories here in this country. And also, if we have time, we'll look at Andrew Jackson, the seventh president, who was popular because of him fighting Native Americans. Actually, he's known for the Native Americans being sent to Oklahoma to become farmers, and Trail of Tears is called. They all walked from Florida all the way to Oklahoma, some dying on the road. We know that he did more than just mess with the Native Americans who were in Florida, and one of the auspices of the Spanish. But he went even a step further than that. He tried to kill them all, slaughter them. And because the United States had no business in Florida, because Florida at that particular time was a property of the Spanish government. But those particular Native Americans that were there were all rounded up and had to go to Florida. Let's see if we can find something else. We're going to move on and talk. First of all, we're going to talk about Monroe. Let's take a listen to something that's been stated about James Monroe.
In person, James Monroe cut the figure of the quintessential hero of the Revolution, from his boots, breeches, and ceremonial sword, right up to his cockade hat.
The funny thing about James Monroe is that no one ever seems to have thought terribly well of him, except his character. Everybody said he was honest, and everybody said he was trustworthy, but no one ever said he was extremely intelligent. Yet this man must have been doing something right, because he gets elected twice to the presidency by crushing margins.
Monroe's presidency was so seemingly amicable that he was unopposed when he ran for his second term.
He had, in many ways, a falsely easy presidency. This is supposed to be the era of good feelings. He seems to reign over a period of peace and happiness in America.
But not really.
At the beginning of Monroe's first term, the territory of Missouri petitioned for statehood. In theory, adding a star to the flag should have been cause for national celebration. Instead, it ignited a great political debate over slavery. Would Missouri be a free or slave state? As Congress debated the explosive issue, Monroe, a slave owner himself, made it clear that he would veto any legislation that restricted self-determination for any state. Eventually, Congress passed the Missouri Compromise of 1820.
Missouri enters the Union as a slave state. Maine enters the Union as a free state. And prohibitions are put upon the expansion of slavery.
While the slavery question simmered, Monroe faced a border crisis in Florida. The territory was still owned by Spain, but the Spanish did little to govern it. By 1818, border incursions were common. Seminole Indians, in particular, were raiding white settlements in Georgia. These raids were often encouraged by British privateers who operated on the Florida coast. In response, Monroe sent troops to the region, led by the hero of New Orleans, General Andrew Jackson. In 1819, the Spanish ceded Florida to the United States without a fight. Border disputes were constant during Monroe's tenure. Significantly, it was a border issue that led to Monroe's defining moment in office. In December 1823, the president delivered a message to Congress and to the world. Ostensibly, he addressed a minor dispute between Russia and the United States over Alaska. But the speech contained a short paragraph that became his legacy. It stated, "The American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers."
The Monroe Doctrine is our statement that we reject European countries coming in and trying to acquire further territorial gains in this hemisphere. You stay in your hemisphere, we'll stay in ours.
It wasn't until 1852 that people began calling it the Monroe Doctrine. The end of James Monroe's presidency was a turning point in American political history. He was the last of the revolutionary generation, the last of the architects of the American Republic.
What you might find extremely interesting about that is that Monroe started dealing with a lot of the
essential hero of the revolution.
Let me cut this down so I can.
And ceremonious
the thing that wants to continue.
Right
play.
Up to his cockade hat.
So, as I was saying before, the Monroe Doctrine is still considered to be a very famous piece of paper today. It had nothing to do with slavery, but it had something to do with other countries trying to take over pieces of land that, like, for example, Spain, down in the Louisiana, that area down that, and all the way on down to Florida, really had to, were getting ready to fight us for their land. And eventually, through some smart maneuvering from a man who wasn't considered to be that intelligent, did something about it and stopped it. So he had bouts with the Russians because of Russia and Alaska is not considered to be that part of our country. And there was a big war of words with the Russian people and our James Monroe and his particular individuals there at the time. Now we're going to move on to see if we can find out something about this other man who I consider was just ridiculous. That was a person who was very similar to the kind of president we presently have. This is going to last a long time, so we're going to talk about Andrew Jackson. And the person who's doing this is a writer, and wrote the book about Andrew Jackson's reshaping our understanding of this fantastic man. We're going to find out what and who's doing the talking.
The habit of writing prefaces to books. A preface is where an author usually explains why he or she wrote the book at hand. But as a reader, I often found that prefaces got in the way of getting on with the story. So I decided to dispense with a preface in hopes that the reader would dive in on page one and the story would carry the reader forward. As Anne said, there hasn't been a full biography of Andrew Jackson in over 20 years. And the one that everybody refers to when they talk about in the 20 years was Robert Remini's three volumes on Andrew Jackson. They're a wonderful work of historical nonfiction, of biography. But I decided that there ought to be a Jackson between the covers of one book. And so I decided, but there's, after I made this decision, I discovered that, in fact, I couldn't find a full one-volume biography of Andrew Jackson. It seems that when biographers take on Jackson, they get so enthralled by the subject that they go on for two volumes like Marcus James, or three volumes like Robert Remini or James Parton. So the Jackson biographies tend to be these very large things. And I decided that I wanted to do it in one volume. So that was part of the reason that I took on this assignment, that I assigned myself this biography of Jackson. Another reason had to do with the fact, well, it was about the election, it was during the election of 2000, and I recall sitting and watching the presidential debates of that year when Al Gore was debating George W. Bush. And I reflected on the fact, I thought it was very curious, but here were two men who between them had three Ivy League degrees. But in the debates, if you remember, they each competed most vigorously with the other to come across as the one who had the real common touch. They were running away from their elite family backgrounds, their elite education, and trying to make them, each was trying to make himself appear just the common man. And I wondered about this. I wondered, where did this come from? Because it's peculiar in American politics that presidents have to have a common touch, more so than other candidates. For example, if you are a senator from a state, it's no complaint against to be called the distinguished senator from Tennessee or the distinguished senator from Massachusetts or Texas. But presidents are never called the distinguished president. In fact, if you call the president distinguished, the president would probably pull out his spokesman to try to deny the charge, because presidents are supposed to be just ordinary folks. Now, I knew enough about American history to know that this wasn't always so. George Washington would not have been in the slightest insulted or put off to have been called distinguished. In fact, he probably would have wanted some adjective more exalted than that. But it was only in the 19th century that this idea that the president ought to be just an ordinary person, just like the rest of us, took hold. And I'll confess that I knew enough about American history to know that it all started with Andrew Jackson. But I wanted to investigate this further. So I thought that Jackson would be a good subject to try to understand how we arrived at the situation we are in today, where the presidency, the president, is peculiarly the representative of all the people of the United States. And if you think about it for a minute, the president is the only political officer in the United States that everybody potentially gets to vote for. Now, when I say everybody, there are some obvious exceptions to that. And furthermore, still, we don't exactly vote for the presidential candidates. Technically, we vote for electors. But that's a huge step forward from what it was forward, a huge step in some direction from what it was before Andrew Jackson became president. Because until Jackson ran for president in the 1820s, ordinary people didn't even get to vote for electors. In fact, the presidential electors were chosen for the most part by state legislatures. Now, if you really know your constitutional history, or if you were really paying close attention during the 2000 election campaign when things got hung up in Florida, you may remember that you have no constitutional right to vote for president. In fact, I mean, even for the electors for president, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that ordinary people get to choose the electors. All it says is that the states shall choose electors. And the reason this came up in the 2000 election was when the recount was disputed in Florida, there was some talk of the Florida legislature deciding who would get the Florida electors. And so if you go back and look at your Constitution, it's just, it's a matter of habit. in many cases, state law, but it's not a matter of the Constitution. But anyway, ever since Andrew Jackson's era, this notion that the people get to vote for president, even if somewhat indirectly through the electors, which may become a relatively straightforward pass-through, it's only since Jackson's age that that has taken hold. And in fact, when Jackson was inaugurated in 1829, there was this understanding that Jackson was peculiarly the people's president, and in a way that the no president before him had been, and in fact, in a way that every president after Jackson would strive for. And it got to be fairly ridiculous, actually, when William Henry Harrison was running for president in 1840. William Henry Harrison was a college man at a time when people who had gone to college constituted maybe 5% of the population. He was wealthy, he was well-heeled, but he ran what was called then and has been known by historians ever since, the log cabin and hard cider campaign. He was trying to essentially out Jackson. And Andrew Jackson thought that it was a scandal. Of course, the fact that Harrison was of the Whig political party and Jackson didn't like his politics contributed to Jackson's view of the whole thing. But nonetheless, this idea that the president should be the representative of just ordinary people took hold with a vengeance and has never let go. So these were among the reasons that I chose, that I decided to write a book about Andrew Jackson. And there's one more that I'll share with you, and this is more personal, and this isn't really a good reason, but it's one of the main reasons. About probably 10 years ago, maybe more than 12 or 13 years ago, in my ambition as a young historian, I decided that I was going to become the Will Durant of American history. Now, those of you who are a little bit older may know about Will and Ariel Durant's Story of Civilization. It was all the history that's fit to print in something like 14 volumes or 20 volumes or something like that. It was a multi-volume history of humanity. And it was a huge bestseller when it came out. It's often been thought to be sort of a popularized version of history, but for heaven's sakes, I mean, how can you do any better than that if you're going to take on all of human history? Well, anyway, I decided that somebody ought to do that for American history because nobody had, and naturally I thought it ought to be me. So I proposed this idea to a publisher, and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to write a history of the American people and do it in about, I don't know, 6 or 7 volumes. And this publisher took one look at me and sort of yawned and said, you know, these multi-volume histories, they just don't go anywhere. So I don't think so. Well, I was somewhat put off by this rejection, but not entirely. I still thought it was worth doing. But I realized that if I was going to do it, I would have to do it covertly. I would have to do it by stealth. And so what I got in mind was my secret multiple-volume history of the United States. But it wasn't going to be called that. In fact, it would sort of sneak up on people. But it was going to take the form of a series of biographies. Now, from the very beginning, from the time I first started writing history, which is now about 20 years ago, I was peculiarly attracted to the genre of biography, as in a book about a life. But even in the books that I write that aren't formally biographies, they tend to hang on individual characters. Now, this is partly because in my own experience of reading history, and in my experience of watching other people read history and talk about history, and in my experience teaching, it's a lot easier to get the story of history across when you attach it to individuals. You can write about the history of ideas, and you can write about social classes, and you can write about economic development, and they're really hard for ordinary people, people who don't have a pre-existing interest in history to get a grip on. But once you start telling the stories of individuals, then people respond to individuals because, to some extent, we all go and read history because we want to know what other people's lives were like. So I decided that I was going to do this series of biographies. Now, I had to choose my figures carefully because they had to be, because this was going to be not simply a bunch of lives, but it was going to be a history of the American people told through these lives. So it's no coincidence, as Ann pointed out, that the subtitle of my book, the title is Andrew Jackson. The subtitle is His Life and Times. I come at biography from the direction of history. I'm a historian. So I want to know how the life fits in with the times. And for me, illuminating the times is as important as telling the life story. People who write biographies tend to come from one of two directions. The one direction is the historian like me, who usually places the life fairly firmly in the times. And then there are those who come to biography from the direction of journalism. And so they're working from the present to the past. They're often less interested in the times and more interested in just sort of filling up the story with the life. And both approaches are perfectly valid. But it's if you're interested in knowing what to expect out of a particular biography, it would pay you to take 10 seconds to read The Dust Jacket and find out a little bit about the author. And if you like the full life with relatively little of the times obstructing the view, then choose a biography by someone whose background is as a journalist. And probably the best practitioner of this version is David McCullough, who started out as a journalist and has been writing, well, nonfiction, history, and biography. And his biographies of John Adams and Harry Truman are wonderful, and they both won the Pulitzer Prize, so you can't complain about that. I wish I could have that kind of complaint. Anyway, but those of us who come at it from history tend to think more in terms of how does the life illuminate the times. So my first venture in this field was a biography of Theodore Roosevelt. I chose Theodore Roosevelt for a couple of reasons, partly because he was this big, larger-than-life character, partly because, and this is something that I'm trying to decide whether it applies to Andrew Jackson or not. Theodore Roosevelt is far enough in the past that the politics of his life are no longer controversial. Theodore Roosevelt was extremely controversial when he was alive. He was beloved by certain Republicans. He was a Republican. He was beloved by certain Republicans and some Democrats, but he was despised by most Republicans, even though he was a Republican, and by a lot of Democrats. And it was for taking controversial stands on issues of the day. But the issues of Theodore Roosevelt's day are not the issues, by and large, of our day. And so conservatives and liberals, for different and actually sometimes contradictory reasons, can embrace Theodore Roosevelt. So somebody writing about Theodore Roosevelt doesn't have to worry about stepping on the toes of any particular group. So Theodore Roosevelt was my first entry in this. I haven't figured out how many volumes this is going to be, actually, but it'll probably be about 6 or 7, maybe 8. But he was the first entry into this, and he was chosen partly for his personal characteristics, but also because he nicely covers the period from the Civil War up to and through the First World War. This is the period of the industrialization of the American economy, the modernization of American society, the emergence of the full-blown modern political system, and also the emergence of sort of modern questions of where does government fit in the life of society. Theodore Roosevelt was the first progressive president. Anyway, that's why I chose Roosevelt. Volume 2 was, I backed up. Now, this is just volume 2 and where they were written. Theodore Roosevelt will probably be about volume, 4 or so. Volume 1, the second one written chronologically, was a biography I did of Benjamin Franklin. Now, by the time I got to Benjamin Franklin, I was really clear on what I was trying to accomplish, and this was going to fit in this series. Benjamin Franklin was perfect for me because he covers basically the 18th century. in American history. He's born in the first decade of the 18th century. He dies in the last decade of the 18th century. And in King's case, if the chore of, what shall I say, the chore of American society, the task of American society during Theodore Roosevelt's life was coming to grips with modernization, the task of American society in Benjamin Franklin's life was developing an American identity. And in fact, that's the reason I called the book The First American. And I used the phrase in a variety of meanings. In the first place, he was the first in terms of foremost. He was the most famous, the most distinguished American of his generation. But he was also, the first, as I see it, of the revolutionary generation to perceive an identity of Americans separate from their identity as Englishmen. And so Franklin saw the need for independence before just about anybody else did. But lastly, Franklin really established, you could say, the archetype for the American character, and very much of what people think. When they think about an American character, you can find in Benjamin Franklin. Anyway, so that's why I chose Franklin. Now, the third volume in this series, and this is going to be chronologically volume two, is Andrew Jackson. Conveniently for me, no, it's not convenient. I didn't choose him by accident. But conveniently for my design, Andrew Jackson was born in 1767. So his life overlaps a little bit with Benjamin Franklin's. But that is good, because when somebody is a child, they're not involved in the public affairs of the day. However, as little more than a child, Andrew Jackson was involved with the biggest public event of certainly the first quarter century of his life, the American Revolution. Now, I can't prove this, and so I hesitate to say it with much conviction, but Andrew Jackson had to have been one of the youngest soldiers in the American Revolution. He rode as a courier in the Carolinas at the age of 13. Now, that's about as young as you can get and still be allowed anywhere near soldiers. But it also meant that he was, at the war's end, he was one of the youngest veterans of the war, which also meant that because he lived to a relatively ripe old age, he lived on into the middle of the 19th century. So Jackson's years are 1767 to 1845, which means that for somebody like me, who's trying to write this history of the United States, he covers this long period, and he allows me to develop all sorts of important themes in American history during that period. In particular, what happens to the Revolution? With Franklin, I can fight the Revolution, and the Americans win their independence, and they consolidate their grip over the eastern half of what's now the United States. And in Franklin's last few years, unsatisfied with the way things are going under the Articles of Confederation, they decide to write a new constitution. And fortunately for my purposes, Franklin presided over, well, he was the ex officio host for the Constitutional Convention in his hometown of Philadelphia. And he weighed in at particular critical moments, and he gave the Constitution his blessing. And he provided me with a great closing line. I stole it, so it's not mine. But I end the book by saying that when Franklin and the other drafters of the Constitution came out of the convention in September 1787, and I'll remind you, because I reminded the reader, that the Constitutional Convention was held in secret. Nobody who wasn't a member of the convention got to listen in. And in fact, the secret kept for about 30 years. It was only much later, when James Madison published his notes, that we could figure out who said what at the convention. But anyway, Franklin walks out of Independence Hall, the State House in Philadelphia, at the end of the Constitutional Convention. And a woman of Philadelphia is walking along the street, and everybody for the last 3 months has been very curious about what's going on inside. And so this woman asks Franklin, says, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us by your 3 months' labor?" And he says, "Madam, a republic, if you can keep it." Well, that's my jumping off point for the Andrew Jackson book. The question is, could we keep it? And that's the fundamental task. I said there was a task for American society during the Roosevelt years and during the Franklin years. Well, the task for American society during the Jackson years is, could we keep the Republic? And I will say that during the early going, the answer to that question was hardly foreordained, because, and I hope I don't offend or disappoint anybody in here when I say that I am not one of these people, because I wrote a book about Benjamin Franklin, one of the founders. I'm not one of these people who thinks that the founders were this generation of demigods, geniuses who were far better than we are, who were greater in virtue, greater in intelligence, who did this wonderful thing, and all we can do is hold it up there in awe. No, in fact, I know perfectly well, because I know what Benjamin Franklin and his contemporaries thought of their own handiwork, and this was confirmed by what I learned while I was researching Andrew Jackson. The drafters of the Constitution knew perfectly well that there were two serious flaws in their work. And these were so serious that everybody at the time and everybody for the next 70 years held their breath, wondering if this Constitution that they had created weren't simply going to implode. And the two fundamental flaws in the Constitution were, number one, the question of sovereignty. Which part of the government is actually supreme? Is it the national government or is it the states? You cannot tell from reading the Constitution. Now, the reason you can't tell is the drafters of the Constitution deliberately fudged it. I've asked a question of constitutional scholars that I know, legal theorists, and I asked them, if anybody were going to write a constitution for a state, for a country, suppose you've got this country, and it's an absolutely blank slate regarding its politics, would it ever occur to anyone to set up a federal system? And the uniform answer is no. Nobody ever would. The only reason federal systems get set up is that they get superimposed on some pre-existing political or sometimes ethnic division in society. In the case of the United States, there were these 13 pre-existing states, and they weren't about to vote themselves out of existence. Anyway, so this question of, call it nationalism versus states' rights, that was a fundamental question, a fundamental flaw in the Constitution, because the founding charter of this new organization ought to say, when push comes to shove, who gets the last word? Well, that was bad enough. But the second fundamental flaw with the Constitution, and the one that made the first one about this question of sovereignty so explosive, was the issue of slavery. Because everybody could tell from 1787 that there was a basic contradiction in American politics between the claim in the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, is not part of the Constitution, but nonetheless establishes what Americans believed about their form of government. The basic claim in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and the existence of slavery, which demonstrated quite clearly that however men might have been created on this world, or at least in this country, they definitely were not equal. So it's the task of, as it turns out, Jackson's generation to deal with these questions. What are you going to do about it? And it turns out that Jackson's generation, starting even before Jackson himself, comes to political maturity, starts to deal with these questions in as early as 1798, when the Federalist-dominated Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Act. The opposition Republicans Now, these are the forerunners of the modern Democrats. Jack Thomas Jefferson's party filed petitions claiming that these laws were not valid. These were the so-called Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which proclaimed the doctrine of nullification. Nullification is the belief that states can refuse to enforce, can forbid the enforcement of federal laws that the particular state find obnoxious. If the state of Tennessee doesn't like the latest income tax, federal income tax, then the state of Tennessee would simply refuse to collect it and prevent federal agents from collecting it. This was the essence of nullification. It arose in 1798, and it was supported by no less figures than James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. It would arise again with a vengeance in Andrew Jackson's presidency, because the state of South Carolina, Jackson's native state, would proclaim the right to nullify. It said if Tennessee didn't want to enforce a federal tax, well, that's what South Carolina didn't want to do. And the Union nearly broke apart during Jackson's presidency. This was the first, well, you could call close brush with secession. Now, in fact, by the time Jackson was president, Jackson had sufficient political prestige. He had sufficient prestige as a military leader that he could stare down the South Carolinians. Jackson, when he heard that South Carolina was threatening to secede, ordered his Secretary of War to lay plans for the creation, for the enlistment of an army of 200,000 men, which Jackson intended personally to lead to South Carolina. When a South Carolina congressman was preparing, at the end of the legislative session, the federal session, was preparing to go to South Carolina, he stopped in at the White House and asked President Jackson if he had a message for his constituents in South Carolina. And Jackson said, "Yes, I do. Tell your friends in South Carolina that if any of them should breathe a word of secession," which was the logical consequence of nullification, "if any of them should breathe a word of secession, I will hang them from the highest tree I can find." Jackson, at the time, was the most popular man in America. Jackson was the great military hero of his generation. When Jackson threatened to march an army into South Carolina, people took him seriously. And South Carolina shortly backed down. Now, fast forward 30 years. By the way, when this particular crisis ended, it was a crisis over a federal tax. It was a crisis over a tariff, what the South Carolinians called the Tariff of Abominations. Needless to say, the Congress that passed it didn't call it the Tariff of Abominations any more than Parliament. From your study of American history, you will recall the so-called Intolerable Acts. Well, when Parliament passed these measures, they weren't labeled the Intolerable Acts. That was something that the Americans put on it. But anyway, when South Carolina backed down and Jackson could claim satisfaction for holding the Union together, he predicted that the problem hadn't been solved, because the constitutional question, the nation or the states, that remained subject to debate. Jackson at that time predicted that the issue would rise again. But he said the next time it arose, it wouldn't be over a tariff. It would be over slavery. Because the second theme that runs through Jackson's life, this question of the struggle between the nation and the states, the second theme is evolving attitudes toward and practice of slavery. This book I wrote about Andrew Jackson is in part a tale of and an analysis of how American views of slavery changed over time. And it's quite remarkable. In 1787, when the drafters went to Philadelphia, and when they decided not to decide what to do about slavery, they took a halfway position. They said, 20 years from now, no more slave trade, okay? No more importing of slaves into the United States. By 1787, the northern states were beginning to abolish slavery. And it looked as though slavery was a dying institution, in part because of the Republican conscience, that was small R Republican conscience that was developing in the country. And as Americans began to realize that, you know, slavery and this idea that people ought to be able to govern their own affairs, that's the basis for republicanism, they don't go together. So that was part of it. Part of it, too, was the evolution of the American economy, so that slavery had been marginally profitable in the North in the 18th century, but by the 1780s, it had become unprofitable. And most of the founders thought that it would probably continue to lose profitability. And as this Republican conscience grew more acute, and as the profitability of slavery diminished, then eventually slavery would be abolished state by state. And that's important, by the way. It was going to be state by state. No one, not Andrew Jackson, not Thomas Jefferson, not George Washington, not even Abraham Lincoln, believe it or not, thought that the federal government had the right to emancipate slaves, at least not without a constitutional amendment. And that's why Lincoln, even when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, at the same time said there's got to be an amendment to the Constitution. Because you can read that original Constitution, there's nothing in there that says that the president can emancipate slaves. There's nothing in there that even hints that Congress can emancipate slaves. So, as long as until the Constitution spoke on slavery, then slavery was going to be this ongoing problem. Anyway, Jackson is part of this emerging attitude towards slavery. Now, I'm going to tell you some of the challenges that confront a person writing a life about Andrew Jackson. In contrast, for example, to somebody writing about Theodore Roosevelt. When I wrote my book about Theodore Roosevelt, while I was writing that, the book came out, I had all sorts of people come up to me and say, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, he's always been my favorite president. And there are reasons for that. It makes sense. When I was writing about Benjamin Franklin, I had a lot of people come up to me and say, Benjamin Franklin, he has always been my favorite founding father. When I told people I was working on Andrew Jackson, now, I don't live in Tennessee. I live in Texas. And when I was writing about Andrew Jackson, I don't think I had anybody come up to me and say, Andrew Jackson is my favorite president. And I won't say this put me off at all. No, in fact, it caused me to realize that, this is me, the author speaking, that this book potentially could be all the more important for precisely that reason. And here's why. I knew that Andrew Jackson was the most popular political figure of America in the whole first half of the 19th century. Andrew Jackson was the great hero of his generation. In fact, after the Battle of New Orleans in 1815, and for the rest of his life, Andrew Jackson was often referred to simply as the hero. And if you just spoke those words, it was sort of like, you know, in the field of American pop music, you speak about the king. Well, everybody knows you're talking about Elvis Presley. If you're talking about American politics, you spoke about the hero. It was Andrew Jackson. If you look in the index to an atlas to the United States, and you look down and you find the most common place names, counties, cities, towns, so forth, lakes and everything, name for individuals, there are two names that predominate. You know what two names those are? Jackson is one, and Franklin is the other. Yes, so I got at least those two bases covered now. But why is this so? And in fact, there are any number of people who are named boys, mostly, who were named Andrew Jackson Jones, Andrew Jackson Murphy, Andrew Jackson this. In fact, there is a fellow that I know in Texas. He's 92 years old. He's a retired Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. And he always went by the name, his last name is Pope. He always went by the name Jack Pope. But it turns out, as he told me, because I've got to know him, he's actually Andrew Jackson Pope. And he was old enough, and I don't know if he was born in Tennessee or not. He might have been. A couple years ago, I wrote a book on the early history of Texas and the Texas Revolution. One of the things I discovered there, you may all know this, but I didn't know this, that there has been, from the early 19th century, almost a pipeline from Tennessee to Texas. It seems that everybody who got to Texas came from Tennessee, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for bad reasons, sometimes for almost, I don't know if these two words go together, ludicrously tragic reasons. Is the story of Sam Houston well-known in Tennessee? I mean, it certainly is in Texas. But the Tennessee origins of Sam Houston's Texas career are not all that well known. Sam Houston is one of the most remarkable figures in American history. His is really a case of you couldn't make this stuff up because nobody would believe it. But anyway, and of course, Sam Houston was a protege of Andrew Jackson. Okay, so here's the juxtaposition I've got. Here's the question that I have to answer as this biographer of Andrew Jackson, as a historian. How is it that Andrew Jackson was this great figure in the 19th century? There was nobody bigger. In fact, I can't think of an individual in the entire 19th century who rivaled Andrew Jackson in popularity, in perceived importance. Conceivably for Northerners, Abraham Lincoln by the end of the Civil War. Needless to say, not for all Southerners. But Andrew Jackson was this, he really stood way above everybody else. But now, as I said, he's nobody outside of Tennessee's favorite president. And in fact, and why is that? Well, here's, I think, the essential reason. And that is that Andrew Jackson was the quintessential man of his time. And his time is not our time. Why is it that people can warm up to Benjamin Franklin so easily? Well, frankly, because Benjamin Franklin is, I think, of the founding fathers, the most modern. I could very easily imagine Benjamin Franklin being lifted out of the 18th century, given a change of clothes, and put in Philadelphia. You know, he's been and he thought it was a crazy biography.
Cherokee to live as citizens of the United States and citizens of Georgia in Georgia, but they couldn't live as a people apart. One of the things that's not, and Jackson is often portrayed as anti-Indian. Jackson had two Indian fosters to adopt. He had Rachel Adams and Jackson, his adopted children. And so he had nothing against Indians per se. Indians living as separate nations. They have been in all of their lives a threat to the security of the United States. Because Indians in Jackson had allies with British, had allies with French, had allies with the Spanish. Indian nations were a threat to America's existence. Now, this is another essential part of the Jackson story. It's something that we that I have to make for the book. And that is, I think Jackson was a man of his time. Jackson had this preoccupation, almost an obsession, with the security of the United States. In Jackson's view, the United States was under siege, and it was constantly on the verge of falling apart. Well, now we know that it didn't fall apart, and it became the greatest, most powerful country in the world. So it's very always, or at least that insightful would have been that it was becoming thus. But Jackson didn't see that for the very good reason what I just said is false. And I said it didn't fall apart. Yes, it did fall apart. Remember, there was a thing called the Civil War. And Jackson spent his whole life trying to prevent a civil war, trying to prevent the United States from coming under attack for a country. In Jackson, the United States was endangered. Endangered from outside? Well, of course it was. Jackson fought wars against the British, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812. He fought a series of skirmishes against the Spanish. He had to deal with the machinations of France and anybody else might be threatening the United States. Because the United States during Jackson's age was all countries in a big of much greater power. And this was something he had to deal with. He also had to deal with the internal threat. And the internal threat was very real. South Carolina, very conservative. But also, as we know, for all Jackson's efforts to pull the Union together, it didn't stay together. It fell apart in 1861. And it was only held together by the war that Jackson fought people say, because right up until the last moment of his life, he was at the center of things. And for the Tennesseans in the audience, you'll like the ending, because I won't tell you exactly how it ends, but it involves Sam Houston and Andrew Jackson and the culminating moment of their two political careers, and how here's the Jackson dying. But U.S. Congress has blindly agreed to allow Jackson into the Union. So Houston wants to be the one to take the news to Jackson. And so Houston races towards the Hermitage. And I won't tell you how to race. Yes, I do need to have somebody else, and I do have a particular individual in mind. I don't think it's going to be the next book that I'm going to write. Maybe not the next biography. But I think it needs to be a good study of William Sherman. And the reason I would pick Sherman is that not that Sherman is anybody's favorite general. If Andrew Jackson at times was kind of prickly, William Sherman was even more so. But here's the thing. One of the points I make in this Jackson, the great thing about Jackson is, again, I said it explicitly, the president's comment, Jackson was the hero of the age of democracy. Now, we tend to think of democracy as this unalloyed good thing. So, if we can establish democracy in Iraq or the Middle East, then all will be well. Well, democracy works, has worked out okay for the United States, but I would remind you that it had a very difficult youth and adolescence. And in fact, look at Jackson's own presence. The birthing pains of democracy were severe. And I would contend that the American Civil War was a consequence of democracy. So that's the argument that I'm making in this book on William Sherman. But the other thing, the point of the book on Sherman will be, in fact, I even got a working title, and it is The Dark Heart of War. Again, this isn't something that we Americans pride ourselves on. But the very important way, this is a country that was built by war. If you think about it, it's not a triumph for democracy, exactly. It was a triumph of military force. This country was settled. This particular land was settled by force. Jackson stands the first 30 years that he lived in Tennessee fighting Indians. The Civil War, what resolved the question of slavery? What resolved this question of the nation versus the state? It wasn't a Supreme Court decision. It wasn't a vote of the people. It was the fact that the North crushed the South when those two issues were put to death. Now, that doesn't sound to me like a recommendation for democracy. And I don't mean this as, a particular criticism. I think democracy has turned out well for them. But democracy is not by itself the answer to all of humanity's problems. And a book on Sherman will take on this. Other questions?
Mr. Renz, I've got to say here, biography on Sherman is probably the most interesting book I've ever read.
Very good. I have to tell you, I like it, but it's not as good as the Jackson.
until the beginning of the
your journey.